Well, let's get going here. Good morning. Today is Wednesday, March 28th, 2012. It's 9:30 a.m. and City Council will come to order. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good.
Happy spring.
Thank you. You too.
Can you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Here.
Fish. Saltzman.
Here.
Leonard. Adams.
Here.
Quorum is present. We shall begin, beginning with communications. Can you please read the title for item number 300?
Request of Chris Lyons of Mudshark Studios to address council regarding Small Business Development Center.
Hi, welcome. You just need to give us your first and last name, and you'll have 3 minutes, and that clock in front of you will help you count down your time.
All right. It's Christopher Lyon. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Christopher Lyon, and I am one of the owners of Mudshark Studios, LLC. I am here today to thank you all for your efforts in supporting small businesses, and I would like to encourage you to continue this great work. I would like to share with you my business success story. In 2006, Mudshark Studios, a subcontract ceramic manufacturer, was started in a small 400-square-foot Northeast Portland basement, with total sales for the year of $13,000. By 2007, Mudshark Studios had outgrown the small Northeast Portland basement and moved into a 3,000-square-foot garage. By year end of 2010, Mudshark Studios had 4 full-time employees and had sales that topped over $200,000. Even with the large sales volume, my business partner and I had made little profit. It became very clear that we needed help and fast. We were referred to the Small Business Development Center at the Portland Community College and immediately scheduled an appointment with the first advisor available, Jackie Babke. Jackie immediately began to teach us the finer points of how to interpret information from our balance sheets and profit loss statements. With this information, Mudshark Studios was able to increase net profits by 100% from 2010. We began to explain our goals of expansion and complaints of how we were unable to get any banks to lend to us. Jackie then referred us to the capital access team within the Small Business Development Center. I quickly made an appointment with Noah Brockman to seek help in writing a business plan that would get Mudshark Studios the loan it needed. By midsummer of 2011, with production orders pouring in and no room to expand, Mudshark Studios signed a 5-year lease on a 17,000-square-foot building. It became very clear that Mudshark needed a loan to purchase more equipment and have working capital. Starting in late September, I began meeting with Noah Brockman at the Small Business Development Center on a weekly basis. He laid out a very efficiently a business plan outline that contained all the key factors that lenders were looking for. My initial business plan when I first met Noah was 18 pages long. By the end of January 2012, I had a 50-page business plan and over 350 pages of additional documentation. I made 4 copies of the business plan and handed them to 4 different lenders we thought might be interested in working with Mudshark Studios. By mid-February, Mudshark Studios had offers from 2 different lenders. We decided to work with a joint effort between the Portland Development Commission and Albina Bank. During this time, our financial advisor at the SBDC informed us that the Small Business Center was starting a Small Business Management 2 program, and Mudshark Studios qualified for the grant program funded by the Portland Development Commission to cover the cost of the 10-month course. Just last week, Mudshark Studios closed on our $65,000 equipment loan with the PDC and $25,000 line of credit with Albina Bank. We are currently employing 6 full-time employees and 6 part-time and scheduled to hit $480,000 in sales. I urge you to continue to support the efforts of the PCC Small Business Development Center and all other programs designated to help the growth of small businesses. Thank you.
Thank you. And what do you make? What kind of?
We're a ceramic subcontract manufacturer, so we work with like rejuvenation, schoolhouse electric, mm-hmm. lighting, tile, tableware, installations.
And where would people, do you have a website?
Yes, we do. It's mudsharkstudios.org.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me to visit. I'll be looking forward to my visit next month.
And congratulations on your success.
I appreciate it.
Can you please read the title for item number 301?
Request of Latoya Daly to address council regarding new 7-Eleven store in St. John's.
Is Latoya Daly here? All right. Let's move on.
I know she's around. She may be coming in just a bit. Want to go to 302?
Please.
Request of Dave King to address council regarding new 7-Eleven store in St. John's.
Mr. King. Hi, welcome back.
Thank you. You recognize me?
Yeah.
I recognize you. Well, I hope you're familiar with that 7-Eleven that's going in and that they're trying to put in the used car lot of the Chevy dealer in St. John's. That is a corner that's really complicated. You know, as you're going into St. John's, going west on Lombard, you come to that triangle. It's just before that. There's a grade school, James John's School, is a block down the street, so there's a lot of kid traffic around there. And there's, well, Richmond comes in from one side, Lombard kind of splits into Richmond and then going downtown, and then Lombard can turn right, or Richmond can turn, you can turn right on Richmond. Anyhow, it's a complicated corner, and people get confused. You can tell, because I'm confused, trying to describe it. So increasing traffic, there's already been several kids hit on that corner. Increasing traffic with a 7-Eleven there is crazy. It's just crazy to have a store there. A car dealership was okay, you know, wasn't as bad as a 7-Eleven. The other issue I want to talk about is alcohol. We've been, St. John's community has been trying to stop and slow down the alcohol availability, and 7-Eleven is just going to make it even more easier for people to get alcohol. It doesn't need to be more convenient. There's already three 7-Elevens in that neighborhood, and 7-Eleven is a big corporation trying to jump in and grab the business from a deli that's just a block down the street. And that's how they operate. They see a business that's viable. Okay, we're going to come in there and compete with it. The deli is a locally owned, established, liked business. The other day, 2 weeks ago, another woman and I went around talking to neighbors, and it's almost universal that nobody wants that 7-Eleven there. It's just, we were knocking on doors, and everybody, there was one house that wanted something developed on that lot. Other than that, everybody was against it. So what you can do to stop it would really be appreciated in St. John's. Also, Fessenden needs to be, the traffic on Fessenden is a big issue. People are fighting about truck traffic there. It's hard to cross the street. Homelessness, a lot of other stuff going on in St. John's. But okay, thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Can you please read the title for item number 303?
Request of Emil Freeberg to address council regarding new 7-Eleven store in St. John's.
Emil Freeberg, hi, welcome.
Thank you. I'm Emil Freeberg. I am a resident of St. John's, and this is not quite what I pictured in my head, so I'm a little bit terrified to be here.
We're better looking in person?
What? Yeah, certainly. Yes, exactly. So
you're doing just fine. Take your time.
Okay, thank you. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. So I'm here to talk about 7-Eleven, convenience stores, and community development. In 7-Eleven, we have, I believe, five established convenience stores total. Convenience stores are not a bad thing generally. They have their place, such as a highway exit ramp or, you know, a place where there's not already established resources. Convenience stores are generally open 24 hours, or in the case of 7-Eleven, from 7 a.m. to 7 or to 11 p.m., which is a really long time to be open for a business where people walk in, they make a purchase, they walk out, they drive in, they drive out. So it increases the traffic in the neighborhood, and it also, for residents who are living right around that area, it becomes kind of a blight, actually. You know, lots of lights, lots of traffic, lots more people, noise, et cetera. They generally sell mass-produced single-serving items that are not produced locally. And we know this from the logo-laden garbage that blows around the surrounding neighborhood on a regular basis. In St. John's, we've been growing in small locally owned businesses with sustainable practices. We know our merchants, and very often they're our neighbors. Despite what 7-Eleven says of their intent, a convenience store does not build a sense of community unless you're Jay and Silent Bob, which is not what we want. 7-Eleven has proposed a new store at 8157 North Lombard Street. There are already three convenience stores within a half-mile radius of that lot. We understand the right of free enterprise. However, we're we also understand market saturation and our community's interest in supporting local small businesses. We did have a meeting at the St. John's Community Center several months ago, and 7-Eleven did send a representative, and it was well attended by our community. We asked 7-Eleven to find another location. We told them another convenience store would encroach upon existing businesses and their own franchise owners. We gathered almost 2,000 signatures of St. John's residents against this new development, which is pretty good considering there is something like 14,000 people estimated to live within a one-mile radius of that spot. 7-Eleven was unconcerned, and they have not been dissuaded from finding another location. So we're here today in the hope that by sharing this issue with you that we can get some help in our efforts to keep 7-Eleven from building on this location. So I think I did okay. Thank you very much.
You did really well. Thank you very much. Very well spoken. Can you please read the title for 304?
Request of James Lopes to address council regarding missing children.
Mr. Lopes. Hi, welcome.
Thank you, City Council. I wish I had better news for you.
Thank you. A little closer to the mic, it's hard to hear.
I wish I had better news for you, but
And for the record, your name is?
My name's James Lopes. Nice to meet you. But I'm sure we can get to some conclusion of some better findings. My children disappeared about 7 years ago in Beaverton County with my ex-wife, and I later found out with police reports that they somehow finagled the court and disappeared out of my life. So nothing seemed any weirder to me other than about 3 years later, something happened that I've already addressed you guys about. It was a crime syndicate that I figured was out in Portland because I had a home, actually two homes, taken over by these people. And next thing you know, I'm around all sorts of organized crime. I'm sitting there going, what's going on here? But next, the funny thing I figure out, and I've watched these people, they've interfered with my work. I've become homeless and came down to Portland, Oregon to see if I can draw these people out. And the thing that I've figured out most of all is they are with, my church knows about these people. They're definitely human trafficking or working with Planned Parenthood or some sort of thing like that, because my ex-wife had issues with child molestation. So when there's enough kids put in front of me, and I already put in a letter to you, and I asked for a letter in return, and I didn't get any letter back from you guys. But this is also a letter that I'd like to submit to you guys. I don't know, give it to her. But I wrote this letter to all the legislation, the Senate, the House, and the governor. But that was also, I've sent them two letters, I've sent you guys two letters, and I told you, and these people actually have audio and videotape of mine that belongs to me too. So I'm here to address you guys to see what we're going to do about this.
Where is Beaverton County?
Beaverton County is over on the other side, but I've been in this county for
You said this happened in Beaverton County?
It happened in Beaverton County.
You mean the city of Beaverton?
That's where my kids disappeared from.
Got it. Okay.
Now I went to the hospital numerous times, and these people have tried to set me up with different crimes, and I had to figure out they were police officers whole time.
Mr. Lopes, if you could give your contact information to Chad there, and we'll follow up. Chad is in the green shirt.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sounds wonderful.
All right, we'll now consider the consent agenda. Does anyone have any items to pull from the consent agenda? All right, Carla, can you please call the vote on the consent agenda?
Ritz.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Adams.
Aye. consent agenda is approved. We have a time certain report. Can you please read the title for 305?
Accept the Office of Equity and Human Rights recommendations on a Bureau Advisory Committee.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. It is with great pleasure that I bring this report to Council as required under our ordinance, which we passed September 21st, 2011. I'm going to ask Dante James, the Director of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, to come forward. And when we established the ordinance, we said we would provide a progress report to Council and the community within 6 months from the date of adoption on the structure of the Bureau Advisory Committee for the office. The Office of Equity and Human Rights is established to ensure fairness for all Portlanders and equal opportunity and access to city services, jobs, and contracts. The disparities that exist in Portland have been appalling, and we've been hearing the reports from the communities of color over the past 6 months, which evidence that we've done enough studies. It's time for action. And so the mayor and I, along with the community, conducted a nationwide search to find the right director for the Office of Equity and Human Rights. Dante James comes to us from Denver, Colorado, bringing 20 years political and legal experience as an attorney in private practice, nonprofit director, administrative hearings officer, community organizer, government administrator, and political consultant. Dante is a U.S. Army veteran who was an appointee of Denver Mayor Wellington Webb, leading the Mayor's Office of Contract Compliance. And for 6 years, he worked as advanced staff for the Clinton administration nationally and internationally. So Dante will be giving our first report from the Office of Equity and Human Rights.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, it's certainly an honor. I certainly appreciate the chance to come and speak to you this morning. I know there's been a lot of questions as well as interest and excitement about this new office, and so I hope to come and provide some information for you about what I've been doing in my, I think, 11th day on the job at this point. As well as provide the advisory committee structure that we've looked into. If I might just make a few remarks just to start with, since I know there is, I think, a great deal of groundswell of questioning about the office, and I certainly have done some of my due diligence on the background of the structure and the presentation and the creation of the office, and there was a lot of work that went in, certainly from all of your perspectives and parts, as well as the community work and those involved from the city government side. As I see it, and as I hope to bring this forward, equity by itself is not a program. It's a methodology for doing business. It's not diversity. It's not affirmative action. It's not EEO. It's a question of how the city delivers its services to all of its citizens in the best manner possible. And besides that, it's a business imperative. When conventions don't come to the city, when businesses choose not to relocate here because of questions or concerns about how the city does business with its communities, when professionals of color don't come or choose not to stay, the city of Portland loses. And I'm not here because the city is doing things badly. I'm here because the city can do things better. And as I continue to navigate Portland's unique governmental structure, I truly look forward to your support in the process of continuing to promote equal access and fairness for all of Portland. I have spent in my office and my very, very dedicated and committed staff and skilled staff have spent a good bit of time doing some visioning in a way to get us to a vision and mission statement, which we have completed, and I'm happy to give you a copy of that or read it for you if you would like, and begin a process of strategic planning for how we're going to begin within the first 90 days of looking at our goal setting, as well as 6 months and a year and beyond. Putting a mindset of equity together, as well as toolkit in which to do that is not a 6 month, it's not a year. I came here with a 10-year plan and truly hope that everyone can be supportive and involved in this process as we move forward. In meeting with the creation committee, the office is now created. So they were trying to figure out the best way to move the structure forward. So their decision in conjunction with the commissioner's office, with Commissioner Fritz's office and myself, is initially to create a steering committee that will advise and be together through the end of this fiscal year in a small form, 7 to 10 members of the entire creation committee, to assist in strategic planning, goal setting, visioning as we move forward. And then at the end of this fiscal year, then a larger advisory committee would be created to then continue in an ongoing process in order to continue to advise and work with the office as we do what we do. I know you have the report, so it's fairly short, sweet, and to the point. So that's the structure as has been decided by the committee and the commissioner's office and myself.
Let's pause to see if there's any council questions or discussion.
So the creation, you're taking 7 to 10 members of the creation committee to form the interim advisory committee? Is that
yes,
correct?
A steering committee in some sense, yes. They decided to shrink themselves so that they could utilize the best skill sets to offer strategic planning and organizational skills to the offering of support.
Okay. And then there will be an ongoing Bureau Advisory Committee as well?
Yes.
Okay. But not necessarily those people?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Any other? Well, we're thrilled to have you on board and look forward to the work ahead. And it's exciting to have the permanent director in place. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. And we're excited to continue the work. So thank you. Is anyone signed up?
We had one person.
Great.
Chris Lyon.
Thank you. You can take your seat.
Thank you very much.
Chris Lyon. All right. I move acceptance of the report.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Carla, can you please call the vote on the motion to accept the report?
Fritz?
Well, this indeed is the end of the beginning and the beginning of the rest. And I'm very grateful to my colleagues on the council for your support on this and for Dante for explaining what we're going to be doing. And when he talks about a 10-year plan, yes, it may take us 10 years to eliminate the disparities that have grown over centuries. But as he said, we are moving forward rapidly, and we have established a vision and a mission in 11 days that he's been here. We'll be moving forward with a strategic planning process, which we'll be completing by the end of the year, so by the end of the fiscal year. So we understand the urgency and the need for actions and also the identification of benchmarks and measurables. I appreciate everybody who's been working on this and the willingness of city staff throughout the bureaus as well as my colleagues on the council to make this a successful effort in very short order. We do not have time to waste on this effort. We don't have money to waste on this effort. We are not wasting it. We are spending taxpayers' money wisely so that all Portlanders, people with disabilities, communities of color, people in all areas of the city have access to city jobs and services. And so I'm very pleased with the way this report has come to council in very short order. Appreciate all of the work of the staff in the office and look forward to working with my colleagues as through the budget process and as we move forward. Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Leonard.
Welcome to Portland, Dante, and I look forward to working with you. Aye.
Adams.
Again, thank you. Aye. Report approved. That gets us to the regular agenda. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 322?
Direct the Bureau of Transportation to adjust monthly Smart Park parking garage rates to reflect market parking rates and eliminate certain monthly Smart Park parking garage permits effective no later than June 1, 2012. And enforce short-term parking stalls at all Smart Park garages?
Well, I'm very pleased to bring this forward to the City Council for their consideration. It actually is an indication that our 2009 downtown retail strategy is working. As Council will recall, when they approved the report, this was an effort of merchants and restaurateurs and also city staff, co-chaired by myself and Scott Andrews, to make the best of the downtown retail core, using Yamhill and Morrison as the spine of what will be our premier retail district, and then concentric circles out from that throughout the downtown. This past holiday season, established and new retailers experienced double-digit increases in sales. We worked hard. The basic strategy of the downtown retail strategy is to curate the best national and local firms, and to the extent that we can have them right side by side with each other, the better. The national firms have the advertising budgets. They can bring customers downtown with their recognized names, and then our local firms benefit from that as folks walk by, and they also benefit by being able to be close to the restaurants that we're recruiting for this area. Since the strategy was in place, we've successfully recruited H&M, Sephora, the new Nike, Punch Bowl, which will be going into the Pioneer Place 2, Target on the west end of the district, and local businesses like Joe's Burger, Crafty Wonderland, a new Elephant's Deli, Boys Fort, Downtown Artistry, Saturday Market Annex, Trillium Artists, and the list goes on. The result of all that is that underperforming parking garages owned by the city of Portland are now, some of them, maxed out in terms of access for short-term parking. And so today, we're here to change the way we operate some of those garages in terms of long-term parking that we added to the garages so that we would continue to be able to pay the bills. Now we can get rid of some of that long-term parking and add back the short-term parking for which they were built to serve in the first place. So should I turn it over to Mr. Rist?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor Adams. Good morning. John Rist for the record, Bureau of Transportation. Joining me is Michael Jacobs, General Manager of the parking garages in the Bureau. The ordinance before you, as the mayor just has pointed out, the ordinance before you is an attempt to respond to the markets and the increase in retail activity in the downtown core. And I will just summarize very quickly the four major points of the ordinance. One is to adjust the rates to reflect the market rates around the 4th and Yamhill and 10th and Yamhill garages. Those rates would be at least $10 higher than the average rate of private spaces surveyed within a four-block radius of the two garages.
Is that a monthly permit
Correct.
Rate?
Okay. Correct. Correct. Second major point of the ordinance is to direct the Bureau to eliminate the use of monthly parking at the 3rd and Alder garage effective June 1st, no later than June 1st. Third major point is to work with our customers as we transition some of them to private garages. And the fourth point is to enforce the four-hour limit parking spaces in these downtown retail core garages. So that's the ordinance before you. Those are the major elements of the ordinance, and be glad to answer any questions.
I have a question. So there's no adjustments to the short-term parking rates?
That's correct. Okay. That is correct.
Okay. And then to enforce the four-hour limits, you're going to use existing parking enforcement?
That is correct.
Whoever has the downtown routes will now just go through the garages as well.
Correct. In these three core garages we're going to start with, in the three core retail garages. And that authority exists within city code for our parking enforcement officers to do that.
So no additional staff?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
I wanted to, I asked to put it in just because I think people might be surprised to see our parking enforcement folks in the garages, so I just wanted to flag it publicly. We've always had the authority to do that, but now we're going to exercise
it. Right, and now we're going to actually do it. That is correct.
Any other discussion? All right, thank you, gentlemen. Does anyone sign up to testify?
Yes, we have one person, Lisa Frisch.
Ms. Frisch. Lisa Frisch works for the Portland Business Alliance and is part of our core team that has helped us put together the downtown retail strategy and has been key in implementing it, and deserves our thanks for helping with all the great momentum and success that we have. Welcome.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for all your help. Thank you for that great introduction. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Lisa Frisch. I am the Downtown Retail Development Manager for the Portland Business Alliance, and I am here today on behalf of the Downtown Retail Council to express our support for the ordinance before you today to provide convenient and affordable parking to downtown retail and business customers. Excuse me. 4 years ago, under the leadership of Mayor Adams, the Downtown Retail Vision Task Force was formed. This public-private partnership was charged with bolstering downtown retail by creating a signature retail area on Yamhill and Morrison Streets called the Pioneer District, and supporting it with marketing and branding, business development, streetscape refinement, and strategic investments. We are happy to report today that the collective work of the task force has made the mayor's downtown vision a huge success. Downtown retailers are reporting an estimated 10% increase in sales from 2010 to 2011. The downtown retail vacancy rate is under 5%, which is unheard of in several parts of the country. Downtown has several exciting new local and international retailers and restaurants, including Nike, Sephora, H&M, Ringside Fish House, Shreve & Company, Cafe Yum, Ruth Chris Steakhouse, Joe's Burgers, and a future City Target and TJ Maxx. These new amenities and destinations will provide new, exciting things for our downtown workers and visitors to do. In addition to the new retailers, Pioneer Place is working to re-tenant their facilities with new large-scale retailers, restaurants, and entertainment facilities, which are expected to draw thousands of new visitors to the Pioneer District. The resurgence in this downtown vitality brings a huge demand for short-term retail customer parking within the Pioneer District. With limited on-street parking spaces in the retail core, the city-owned Smart Park garages meet this retail parking demand. In fact, they were built specifically with this purpose in mind, to provide short-term parking for downtown retail customers. These facilities are an integral part of the success of downtown Portland, which competes with free and abundant parking in suburban malls. Parking is a very limited resource in the retail core, and our customers need and demand low-cost, safe, convenient access to parking so they may patronize our businesses. We're very pleased that the city is securing parking spots for retail customers in 3rd and Alder Garage. This will go a long way in making sure our customers have convenient and easy parking. We are also pleased when more retailers open their doors and even more expected demand comes online in the Pioneer District. Additional short-term parking spaces will be made available in those other Pioneer District garages. We urge the city to keep the short-term hourly rate at $1.50 at this time, and we will continue to encourage our businesses to offer parking validation vouchers to their customers. Thank you again, Mayor Adams and Commissioners, for your leadership on downtown retail revitalization, and thank you for taking these immediate actions today to support downtown business environment. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, thank you for all your efforts. All right. Carla, can you please call the vote on this emergency ordinance?
Fritz.
Well, thank you to the Portland Business Alliance for bringing this to our attention and to Mayor Adams and his team for taking action so swiftly. It's very good to know that there's now a resurgence in demand for short-term parking downtown. It is a wonderful, vibrant downtown, and it proves that our investments in the Downtown Business Initiative and other strategic ways of making sure that people come downtown and that there are opportunities for businesses to thrive downtown are succeeding. So, again, thank you, Mayor Adams, for your efforts. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, yeah, this is a good move. We need to make sure that our garages are available for people shopping downtown primarily. So this is a good move to free up some spaces and to find and to enforce them, too. I mean, that's good, too. I know that we want to make sure that people are using our garages on a short-term basis and hopefully spending their dollars in the downtown retail core as they're doing that. So please to support this. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
I want to thank Rehana Ansari for all of her work in my office, along with Peter Periso on the Downtown Retail Initiative, and then also Catherine Charlo and Katya Dillman and Tom Miller and the folks before us from Bureau of Transportation. This is an interim step. Rates for all bureaus come back as part of the budget process, and we'll have an opportunity to tweak this further if we need to, as we look at all the rates for all the bureaus in the city in the upcoming months. So thank you, gentlemen, for your great work. Aye. So approved. We are now at item number, can you please read the title for presentation, item number 323.
Overview of Portland Harbor Superfund process.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. I have asked the Office of Healthy Working Rivers and the Bureau of Environmental Services to bring this Superfund briefing to the City Council to provide an overview of where we are to date, what we can expect moving forward, given the submission by the Lower Willamette Group of the draft feasibility study later on this week. The Bureau of Environmental Services has been extensive in their participation since before the Superfund listing in 2000, and of course extensively after that in technical research and technical support. The Office of Healthy Working Rivers participation, which the Mayor and I created in 2009, has been more recent, with responsibilities to ensure that the city meets both its obligations and intentions in the Superfund cleanup process, protecting and restoring the ecological, transportation, and recreational roles of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, and rehabilitating contaminated, inactive properties with prosperous working harbor opportunities and supporting river-dependent jobs. Of course, the Bureau of Planning Sustainability has also been heavily involved in the river planning process. So we have the three members of the council currently sitting up here, the Mayor, Commissioner Saltzman, and myself, deeply invested in the Superfund process and making sure that we coordinate across all city bureaus. So over the summer, we will be having a further discussion and education on the whole process, but I wanted to have this opportunity to lay out in public what we've done, where we are, what some of the terms mean, just as a briefing to set the stage. And I now turn this over to Ann Beyer, the Director of the Office of Healthy Working Rivers, and Dean Marriott, the Director of the Bureau of Environmental Services.
Thank you, Mayor Adams, members of the council. I am Dean Marriott, Environmental Services. With me, Ann Beyer, as Commissioner Fritz said. I'm going to start, then Ann's going to bat clean up here. See if we can get the slideshow up. As the commissioner indicated, this is our opportunity to come before council and in a public forum to talk about where things stand with the Portland Harbor Superfund. The timing is, I think, appropriate because things are going to start happening, and I think you're already starting to see more interest out there in the public and the press about what's coming. So we thought this would be a good opportunity to come in and give you the sort of overview. We're going to talk about the harbor, a little bit about the efforts associated with the city and our work we've done to date, and then describe the process going forward. Just a quick word about the Portland Harbor Superfund site. Of course, it was designated in the year 2000 by EPA. The statute is actually Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act of 1980, CERCLA. Everyone refers to it as the Superfund Law. There you can see the map from Sovey Island essentially to actually more appropriate to suggest it's the Broadway Bridge area of the city is the designated area. So stakeholders in the process, lots of them. I've listed them here, local business and industry, many public entities, including the port, the city, and state agencies. Of course, there's countless numbers of local citizens interested, environmental groups, fishing interests. The lead environmental agencies, both at the federal and state level, of course, tribal governments, very interested for obvious reasons, and natural resource trustees play a significant role. There have been two processes going on. The deal was basically struck around the year 2000 when the site was listed. You may remember there was some contention back then about whether this should be a state led cleanup process or a Superfund process. And what happened was EPA was designated to take the lead on the in-water issues, and the state, through DEQ, was designated to take the lead on the upland site issues. And so that's what this chart shows, the two working together with the Lower Willamette Group and other interested parties on in-water issues to the left-hand side of this slide, sediment investigation, and then on the right-hand side is the source control and upland contamination issues. The DEQ is primarily interested in focusing on getting agreements with potential sources, ongoing sources of contamination. What we do not want to do is have progress made in cleaning up the harbor and the sediments. If we still have ongoing sources, that would be a terrible waste of effort. So DEQ is taking the lead there. And, of course, the City of Portland is working with both agencies very closely. Related, I know some of you have been following this very closely, is something called the Natural Resource Damage Assessment, or NRDA, process. This is separate from the EPA-led cleanup process through Superfund. This the NRDA restoration efforts are directed by a trustee council. They're evaluating the damages to the natural resources that occurred over time due to the contamination caused to the area, and they're developing a restoration plan to compensate for those losses. So again, sort of two parallel processes underway at the same time. We have an interesting and complex role. We're a member of this 10-member organization that was set up in 2000 called the Lower Willamette Group. We wanted to show leadership and be involved from the beginning, and so we've been an active member in the Lower Willamette Group. This is the group that has funded all of the investigations so far and is submitting the draft feasibility study, which I'll talk about in a second, to EPA later this week. I've also been funding all the agency participation costs and tribal participation costs to date as well. The city is also designated as a potentially responsible party, and we are, of course, have been actively over the last 12 years evaluating our own systems and to be sure we understand just what role we may have played in the contamination of the harbor. We're also, of course, interested in a fair and appropriate allocation of responsibility for the ultimate cleanup. We want to make sure that our public interest and our ratepayers and taxpayers' interests are protected in that process. Also play a stewardship role, of course. Our leadership in cleaning up the Willamette is well known, and we want to continue that stewardship role. And, of course, we want to continue our active engagement with other government entities. We've been very active with environmental services and others in the city, working with the Oregon DEQ on identifying sources and potential sources and making sure that there are plans in place to control those, to make sure, as I said earlier, there's no ongoing contamination problem. Just a quick walk through the timeline. Superfund listing in 2000. During that time, a lot of research, sampling, and analysis has taken place, as well as some early action for cleanup. The next stage is remedial investigation, which is where the risk assessment analysis has been done. What are the risks? The draft feasibility study, that work has been going on, and as I indicated, will be submitted to EPA at the end of this week. That document describes the cleanup options, full range of cleanup options, from basically do a lot of dredging and removal to allowing for a lot of natural recovery and everything in between on that spectrum. Then it's in EPA's hands. They'll develop a cleanup plan, and that will be submitted for public comment fairly soon. And we'll have more to say about that in just a moment. They will then issue a record of decision. That's their decision that will govern the extent and nature of the cleanup, and then whatever additional cleanup work will follow according to that plan. Just some summaries of some activities since the listing. Obviously, the EPA has been in charge of the river sediment and any early actions for cleanups. As I mentioned, Oregon DEQ for upland source control work. During this time, extensive amounts of sampling, testing, and analysis have been done. There's been an ongoing active citizen advisory group that's been meeting regularly. Meanwhile, Oregon Health Division has been issuing and updating any fish advisories for the area. And as I mentioned, there have been some early cleanup action. So just to sort of recap what we've learned, there's a map of the area from Sovie Island to the Broadway Bridge. The primary risk drivers have been identified already from the contamination, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, extensive contamination from that chemical, a variety of pesticides, including DDT. DDT was manufactured within the study area, so that's not surprising. Dioxin and furans as well, and something called PAHs, or polycyclical aromatic hydrocarbons, very associated with oil and petroleum products. So those are the main drivers of the contamination and the risk in the area. What's being presented to EPA later this week is the draft feasibility study. And as I mentioned earlier, it will take into account a wide list of alternatives for dealing with the contaminated sediment, including, as I mentioned, dredging, also capping in place to protect from any migration or exposure, as well as monitored natural recovery and a possibility of hybrid recommendations based on those alternatives. So next steps, Lower Willamette Group, as I said, will submit at the end of this week. EPA will review the document. EPA will ultimately issue a proposed cleanup plan after considering public comment, and then they will issue the record of decision. So all that's going to be happening in the next couple of years. As I said, after a 12-year evaluation, investigation, an extensive amount of work about this harbor, we're now getting into the decision-making phase. And Ann's going to talk to you a little bit about what the public information and outreach efforts that we would like to participate in.
Certainly. Thank you, Dean. Commissioners, beginning after the submittal of the Lower Willamette Group's feasibility study, there'll be a series of public forums that are hosted by the Environmental Protection Agency to make the public aware of what the feasibility study contains. Those will be beginning in April, April 11th and 12th. There'll be one in the Portland building on the 12th, and then others later in the month. Those are really just public information sessions. There's no real opportunity for public comment until EPA issues the proposed plan. We don't quite know when that will be. A year or so from now probably will be when EPA has digested the feasibility study. Dean, if you could switch. There'll be additional information. The feasibility study will be posted on the Lower Willamette Group's website beginning on Friday. There'll be a short executive summary of about 4 pages and a longer executive summary of about 40 pages. The feasibility study itself and all the supporting data is about 7,200 pages. There'll be one hard copy available at the St. John's Community Center, but people will be able to download various pieces of the very immense piece of work. We'll have information updated on the city's website. We've also included a list of acronyms at the end of this presentation so people can understand the language of Superfund and the cleanup process. So thank you for your time today.
That concludes our presentation. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions, discussion?
I guess question. So the feasibility study that we're submitting at the end of the week has the buy-in of the entire Lower Willamette Group. Is that safe to assume?
Okay. Yes, they're ready to present it to EPA.
And are there costs associated with various cleanup options in the feasibility study or not?
There's a range of costs that's reflected with the different cleanup options.
And so the next step after we submit this, EPA will do some public information. They're going to do our PR work, basically. And then the next step is the record of decision, which would be
This is a draft document that's submitted to them. It's the agency has to approve the feasibility study. So we're anticipating there'll be some back and forth. They may request some refinement or additional information, but ultimately, once they're happy with it, they issue the feasibility study. And that may take a few months, or we're not exactly sure.
And the feasibility study is an input to EPA's proposed cleanup plan for the harbor. That comes out, and that is available for extensive public comment. So,
and that's the record of decision, correct?
That's before the record of decision. So it's very confusing. So the proposed cleanup plan, public comment, after EPA considers that public comment, then EPA issues the record of decision. So we're a couple steps away in the process from a final decision, and it's important to remember that the Environmental Protection Agency is the decision maker in this. So.
And then also, at some point after that, isn't there a panel that will decide the allocation of the cost amongst the potentially responsible parties?
Yes, and that's yet a separate process. And
but that's after a record of decision has been finalized, is that correct?
Yes, the allocation process has begun. Yeah. It's a voluntary process undertaken by the potentially responsible parties in an effort to do it without litigation. So that process will, of course, be timed with the record of decision so that once the record of decision is issued, then the allocators will know exactly what needs to be allocated. But in the meantime, they are assembling information about everyone involved and all their activities and the extent of their activities so that they can begin to determine relative shares of contribution.
So potentially responsible parties that are members of the Lower Willamette Group are working on cost allocation.
We're all submitting information.
Okay, but yes. So what about all the
a portion of the up to 130 potential responsible parties?
Of course, yeah, that's what I was going to say. So that was my next question. What about the other potentially responsible parties who are not a member of the Lower Willamette Group?
They're also
they're subject to the cost allocation.
Yes, I believe they're participating as well. I can get, if there are any that aren't, I can let you know that afterwards, but I believe that they're participating.
And then, you know, looking down the road, so costs are allocated. Is that subject to, are those decisions about the cost allocation by this allocation committee subject to lawsuits? So, I mean, if a one party is not happy with its cost allocation, can it sue somebody?
That's a very good question, Commissioner. I actually don't know the answer to that, whether in participating they agree not to. But in this country, I'm reluctant to say. We do have legal
Ms.
counsel
Betts,
here.
Could you come up and answer Commissioner Saltzman's question to the best of your ability, knowing that it is an incredibly complex process?
Yes, Jan Betts with the City Attorney's Office. And the answer is that, yes, parties can sue. The purpose of having a non-judicial allocation process is to do it outside of the litigation arena. And when that decision, when the allocation decision is made by the allocation team, it will be presented to EPA and must be approved by EPA. Parties who are not happy with the way the allocation came out can go ahead and sue other parties. But
sue other parties, not EPA?
Right. The other parties, they all sue each other. But generally, the non-judicial allocation process is one that largely resolves the issue because it tends to be in the economic interests of parties to do it non-judicially and not fight it out in the courts for a number of years because that will end up costing them more.
One of the things that I've, correct me if I'm wrong, is one of the incentives, specific incentives for businesses to not sue is that it can affect their ability to get access to capital if they have this unresolved liability hanging over them. least that's one of the levers we hope for.
Yes.
So, Dean, as far as the how we're going to pay for this, I want you to tell folks what is the line item that ratepayers see on their water and sewer bills for Superfund? What has that been used for?
The Superfund, Portland Harbor Superfund charges what's been used to pay the transaction costs of the city to participate in the Lower Willamette Group. We've spent $23 million to date just into the Lower Willamette Group, which again goes to pay for the cost of the evaluation investigation as well as the agency oversight costs. So it pays for that as well as the city's, our own due diligence to make sure that we understand our system, our collection system, so that we can participate in that allocation process that Commissioner Saltzman was just getting into in a way that we can convince the allocators to make sure that we are treated fairly in that process.
And when we get to the allocation, that $23 million will be credited to our account?
Yes.
So to speak.
That is our...
That's the incentive for participating in early. Those that have sat by the wayside won't get any credit because they haven't contributed anything.
So, and we've also invested in having our staff participate so that the whole feasibility study
yes.
has been done with good technical support. So yes. that's what that money. So we don't have a large super fund anywhere, right? There isn't a super fund bucket in the city of Portland. That's
well, that's the thing. Yeah, we I failed to mention that. There used to be when CERCLA was passed, the federal statute, there was a tax on certain chemicals and all to assist in communities helping to clean up sites. That tax has lapsed many years ago, and Congress has not renewed it, although our Congressman Blumenauer has been vigilant in attempting to renew it. So there is no real super fund at the federal level. It's left to basically companies and communities to come up with the money themselves.
So I just want to make clear to the citizens and the ratepayers and taxpayers of Portland that we have not yet identified how we're going to pay for our share, whatever it may be, and that if I have the honor to continue to serve on the council, that I will be leading that community process to discuss what is it we're going to do, how are we going to do it, and how are we going to pay for it. So the decisions have not been made. The decision won't be made even on Friday. There are formal public comment period doesn't start until the EPA agrees that the feasibility study is what the Lower Willamette Group has suggested it should be, or with refinements. So we're still very early in the process, even though it's been going on since the year 2000. I really appreciate you coming to share this information so that we all know what we're doing, what we're not doing at each step of the way, because we're going to make these decisions together as a community with our various roles in the stewardship and liability and cleanup process. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone signed up to testify? Anyone wish to testify?
This was a presentation. We don't set out sign-up sheets.
All right. Then presentation, right. We don't accept it. All right. Then that gets us to, can you please read the title for emergency ordinance, item number 324.
Authorize acceptance of a conservation easement adjacent to Forest Park.
Commissioner Nick. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Welcome. How are you?
Welcome.
I'm Zelaine Nunn with Portland Parks and Recreation. This ordinance will allow the city to accept a conservation easement over about an acre of natural area that will be next to Forest Park. It's along Skyline Drive. And it will allow parks to protect in perpetuity the natural habitat of the plants and wildlife on this property. It provides some buffer to Forest Park as well from development. There's no cost to acquire this easement. The owner is giving it to us for free. We've conducted our due diligence and haven't found any contaminants or any other problems that we're concerned about. Typically, honestly, this is a pretty straightforward transaction that usually wouldn't be on the regular agenda, but state law requires a public hearing for conservation easements. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All good and no bad.
All good and no bad so far.
Who is Stonewater Inc. who's giving us the...
I believe, I'm not positive of what Stonewater does. The owner of it is a doctor.
And okay.
He owns a couple properties right along there. He's also actually probably going to give us some more property in the area. But he wanted this conservation easement put on the property before someone built a house on the other part of the property that he's selling.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your work. Does anyone wish to testify on this matter? Carla, can you please call the vote on the emergency ordinance?
Fritz?
This is terrific. There's so many both staff in the city and citizens who want to do the right thing in protecting the beauty and the natural resources that make Portland, Portland. So thank you for your work on this. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, this is great. Thanks to Stonewater Inc. for giving us the easement, conservation easement. Aye.